Start recording. Okay. Good afternoon and welcome to the Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting on Wednesday, May 25th, 2022. This virtual meeting is being held under Governor Inslee's COVID-19 Notice of Proclamation 2028. Our community members are welcome to comment on any item or concern via a letter addressed to the commissioners at 834 Sheridan Street, Port Townsend, 98368, or via email to commissioners@jeffersonhealthcare.org. You may join us live on our Microsoft Teams meetings through our website at www.jeffersonhealthcare.org. Select About Us, then Hospital Commission, and scroll down to the links. You may also join audio only at 509-598-2842 and enter the ID number 383-682-973#. This session is being officially audio recorded and time shown on the agenda are estimate only. All commissioners.
He has not yet joined. He's having a hard time getting connected. The link's not working for him.
Okay. We're waiting on Commissioner Clough to join us. All other commissioners are present. So let's go ahead and continue. I now call for a move to approve today's agenda. Is there such a move?
So move.
Is there
second?
Okay, any discussion? All in favor, aye?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, that's unanimous for those that are present. And so we will go ahead and go into our governance discussion, which is a debriefing of the Washington State Hospital Association Leadership Conference in Walla Walla last weekend. And the beginning of last week. So three of the commissioners, me, Mari, and Matt were there in person, and I'm not sure if Bruce or and Case were present by virtual platforms.
I was virtual, and I saw a couple where Case was adding comments, so I know he was on for part of it as well.
Okay, great. This was, as we mentioned last month, this was an educational conference, so we didn't conduct any business there. So this is our debriefing time. So commissioners, what did you think about? Did you come away with any aha moments or ideas that you think we could benefit from? And Bruce, I'll go ahead with you. You're up in the upper screen on my computer.
Well, I wasn't there in person, and I have to say you miss a certain amount of what's going on by being virtual rather than in person. But I thought the topics were good. I mean, certainly a lot of it was about safety, and that's, you know, it's always one of our main focuses is on safety and keeping people healthy and safe. And then you know, there were some on health equity, which is one of the things we're working on as well, and also on leadership resilience. And I thought they were all good topics. On some of them, you can't do it virtually. You know, you can't get into a small group and talk at your table or do something like that. But I had some good conversations with myself. So.
Well, you probably got all the answers you wanted. that you liked.
Yeah, there were only a couple arguments, but.
What about you, Mari?
Yes, well, attending in person certainly, I think, does have more benefits, although it's a long way to go, you know, clear across the state. And I don't know whether that's going to be a regular thing for Wisher being in Walla Walla. Hopefully, justifies the distance. But one of my main takeaways, I endorse everything that Bruce said, was in the in-person, actually standing in line, I think, either standing in line or just conversation at a table, I learned about a hospital district there, a private, not-for-profit in Eastern Washington, where their community stepped up and they were able to raise a considerable amount of money for their major project. I think it was over $40 million. So that was a little heartening from my perspective, and looking at, you know, if we do have to do some campus revitalization of the building that is not needs to be attended to, and certainly to expand the campus. So that was for me quite positive. But the whole conference was positive. It's nice to see people in person and exchange views and ideas.
Okay, great. Matt, what was your take on it?
Yeah, well, I found it was like powerful, just even right at the beginning, just the State of the Union was such a unique talk, because the industry has been through so much, just the review of the last 2 years, and you know, and then just over the weekend, the sharing of the different stories and challenges that people have been through. It was powerful to be back together like that. And I also found of the talks, the one that just like really stuck with me and I found really powerful was the one by the lawyer. The lawyer, I don't remember his name or the group, but the lawyer who was, he was a malpractice lawyer for many years, and he seemed to give very honest, you know, descriptions of what it's like to be a lawyer in the healthcare field, and how his emphasis that lawyers often don't help situations. And the way a lot of, or at least the way they are trained to be just fighters. They're just trained to win. They're not trained to be compassionate and to help communication and to help understanding between all parties. And he gave me hope that at least there is a movement in the legal world to try to have more compassionate, creative, healing type of process when the lawyers and when problems do occur. So I found that really fascinating and powerful. And it was the rest of it. I mean, there were lots of good stuff, but that's the one that really stood out to me.
Yeah, good. And is Case on yet, Brittany? Do you know?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Okay. I don't see you.
Okay. No, that's because my computer just won't refresh the Teams. It says you must refresh to get into Teams, and I've tried about 10 different ways, and so I thought I'll call in instead.
Okay, so, well, great. Good to have you here. However, we'll take you however we can get you.
Well, thank you. And I'll continue to try to see if I can get there a little more in person. But in the meantime, I want to second what I've heard others say, in particular the comments that Matt made about the attorney and the plan that he is working with. And I can't recall if it's the University of Michigan Hospital or somewhere, where they have an incredible program of when there is harm, and there invariably always is harm sometime somewhere in an institution like in healthcare, that they just rush to the patient and are totally open, honest, communicative from minute one in supporting the needs of that family that obviously had an outcome that they weren't expecting and could be devastating, regardless of who is to blame and what the problem was. So I would agree with Matt, and at some point I would love to hear from Rena and Mike and others how what we do compares to this program they have there, because it was very encouraging and inspiring to hear that we could actually have a system that honestly deals with issues that come up. The other thing that I'd like to say, I participated virtually and occasionally saw Mike and other commissioners from our district there from afar. But during the presentation that the individual gave on racism, the what participants who were there in person probably didn't know is that there was this beginning dialogue in the chat from those of us who were virtual. And two people in particular, and I have no idea if they were board members or CEOs or what, were starting this series of comments, including, well, I think, what do you think about the Black Lives Matter? I think all lives matter. And it just went on from there. And I just sort of watched it for a while. And eventually I thought, no, I've got to say something. And I did my darndest to be as civil and understanding as possible and just asked a few questions in the chat. And we actually had a little dialogue going. And by the end of it, we thanked each other for having a reasonable conversation. And so it showed to me the power of just listening, trying to understand another's point of view, even though it may not be the same as ours, and the power of compassionate communication. And so that was really, really, that was the high point for me personally.
That's a great, and I agree all of the things that everybody has said, and I was also happy to see that many of the items that were suggested an effective board does, we are doing. I think that it refreshed me feeling that, you know, we really are on top of things, a lot of the things that we're doing. Sometimes we don't feel that way, maybe, but we are, and we do have our focuses on patients and families. We have a patient story. We share data, the things that all the checklists, as I was going through them, we're on it. Can we improve? Of course, and we're always striving to do that. But I was very, very enthused by what I heard there, and gave me a really good feeling that we're in the right direction. Anything else anybody would like to say? Mike, what was your take on it?
No, I agree with all the other comments. Good stuff. Nice to have patient safety and quality improvement take the center stage again. That needs to be our North Star.
Anything else anybody would like to add about the meeting? Okay, then if Mr. Dingus is ready, we can go right into our next topic, which is the report on the annual financial audit that the board commissions to Dingus, Zerichor and Associates, PLLC. They are a certified public accounting firm that serves healthcare, not-for-profit, and governmental organizations. Once again, we welcome Tom Dingus. He's the founder and owner. And during his more than 25-year career, Tom has worked directly with Critical Access and other hospitals, including us. Nursing homes, rural health clinics, and other public sector organizations. He is a former president of the Washington, Alaska chapter of Healthcare Financial Management Association and served as an officer and board member for 10 years. He's a recipient of many industry awards and regularly presents at Healthcare Association educational meetings on various healthcare topics. So, Tom, it's always a pleasure to see you. Obviously, he's really well qualified, and welcome.
Thank you for that introduction. I was that must be what's on our website.
I ad-libbed some.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, welcome everyone. I think I know all of you from past presentations and other association meetings when we used to meet in more in person. So I'll just kind of jump right into this with after that introduction. And Tom Dingus, I'm going to share my screen. I believe. What are you guys seeing?
We see your PDF now.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so I'm going to today three different documents we'll go through: the actual audit, a letter of things as auditors we communicate with the governing board, and then the financial indicators is the final document. And you know, I kind of give the short story is that there's, you know, it's good results across. There is one little thing that we'll talk about, but it's not a big deal when I get there. So shouldn't have probably said that now to make everybody be ready for it. But I'm going to jump through the financial statements as we go. I'm not going to go through all the pages, but starting with the audited financial statements, there's three different auditors' reports in the financial statements. And on page one, after the table of contents, is the first of the three reports. This is where we give our report on the financial statements, and it's an unmodified opinion, which means that the financial statements that follow present fairly the financial position and results of operations and of the district. If you're reading further through that and you compare it to prior years, auditing standards have changed and the report format is different. In substance, there's not any real change in what we do as auditors. It is, and I agree that it is a better formatted and a clearer and more transparent auditor's report was the objective. Starts with the opinion, goes through the basis for the opinion, talks about responsibilities of management, auditor responsibilities, and then some other information as well. But it does kind of lay out the audit process a little clearer than maybe the old report did. So just for your reading entertainment for later. Then moving on, you know, certainly ask questions anywhere along the way. I forgot to say that at the beginning. And I'm just going to hit on a few highlights here and there in the financial statements. If there's something you would like to ask about or talk about that I skipped through, you know, please let me know. On the statements of net position or balance sheet, nothing really to stand different or noteworthy on this page that we won't come back to in the financial indicators. On the liabilities and net position side, I just to point out a few kind of significant numbers or things that are different. As you'll see in the estimated third-party payer settlements, there's a $4.6 million liability there. In that's from the Medicare cost report settlement. And almost $3.9 million of that was actually paid really early in January as part of a lump sum adjustment is how the cost report rate setting works. But why it's kind of that unusually large is the way as a critical access hospital, you're paid based on cost and your interim rates. And I think I say this in most presentations, but it has more significance in this year and last year than it usually does, is that the interim rates that you were paid in 2021 were for the most part based on 2020's activity, which was lower volumes and costs and impacted by COVID. And so last year you were overpaid in 2020 because it was based on 2019. And this year you were underpaid in the prior year. And this year in 2021, you were overpaid. And so the cost report trues that back up to actual costs. It's essentially, you know, the efficiencies of the relationship of volume to expenses reduced your essentially cost per unit. And so Medicare pays exactly cost. And so there's that true up. I would expect that now, hopefully, that, you know, that operations follow a more traditional path and are a little stabler, the settlements will not be nearly as big in 2022 and going forward. But always some potential for some significant differences there. But in the end, you're always paid cost. And so that's what the cost report does. So that kind of stands out. The deferred grant revenue for the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund, that $2.6 million, it's the second, the bottom up from the bottom line in the total current liabilities, is your phase four and ARP distributions from the Provider Relief Fund that were received late in 2021 that are for really response to COVID and preparation for COVID and being ready for COVID in 2022. The period of availability goes through 2022. So that will be recognized as revenue in 2022. And then the Medicare accelerated payments, which has been, that was there last year, was the advance on payments that Medicare made when the pandemic started back last in March 2020. And it's now getting paid back as withholds through current Medicare remittance advices, and it's about $9 million, a little less than $9 million as of December 31, 2021. And I'll come back to this in the financial indicators, but that's about 24 days of cash, you know, so of what it represents. And that's, you know, the kind of the three main things that are different on this page. And then your operating revenue or your statement of revenue expenses. I mean, you can see the difference between 2020 and 2021, pretty significant, is that revenues, net patient service revenues, were up 18% from the previous year through increased volumes in almost all service lines. And so that's 18%. Interesting enough, that 2020 was actually pretty comparable to 2019. So it's even up compared. It's not that 2020 was necessarily much lower than previous years. It just didn't go up as the normal trend. And then expenses, salaries and wages were up 9% and total operating expenses were up 8%. And you can see that, you know, the revenue was up quite a bit more than expenses, and that flipped your operating margin from the loss of $6.1 million in 2020 to the $5.4 million in 2021. And we'll see that relationship a little more clearly when we get to the financial indicators a little later, but obviously a good trend. And then the significance down here, and the non-operating, is the bottom two lines of the COVID-19 grants and the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund. The money that was all the different COVID relief money that's been received in 2020 and 2021 and recognized. And then there'll be another, as I mentioned earlier, another $2.6 million recognized in 2022. And those are the two line items you'll see that. And then I would imagine that's probably the end of the COVID relief money that hospitals will see. And then your change in net position of a positive $7.6 million. So good results there. Now I'm going to jump a little faster ahead. Statement of cash flows, actual cash in and out. I'm not going to spend any time there. But then to the notes to the financial statements, I always just like to point out that they serve three purposes of who you are as an organization. And that's what the reporting entity does. Nothing different there. And then the summary of significant accounting policies moves on to the how different transactions and balances are reported in the financial statements. Good reading, but not great for me to read to you. And then the rest of the notes are additional information on balances and transactions. And thinking that audited financial statements serve a purpose for management and clearly serve a purpose for you guys in your governing board roles, but they're designed also really for people external to the organization that rely on them. So it's, what would somebody want to know? Citizens, lenders, grantors, creditors, insurance companies. But I'm going to jump way ahead. So it's going to, I haven't designed a better way to do this than just hit scroll forward, but is long-term debt note, just no new debt in 2021. And then I was like, point out that's really super small like that, but just your debt service schedule that shows your debt obligations of your existing debt of what's due in each year. I think that's always got a little bit of value as one of the note disclosures. And then a couple more worth pointing out is, commitments under non-cancelable operating leases. Tyler and his team knows this, but in 2022, the how leases are accounted for changes, and some of these that are previously operating leases with multiple year commitments will get treated as the way capital leases now are now, and there'll be a liability added to the balance sheet and an asset added to the balance sheet, which ultimately kind of presents a truer picture of the obligations you have. So that'll be a fairly significant accounting change and look to next year's financial statements. And then net patient service revenue per patient. I always think this one has value in it. It's like 60% of your revenue comes through Medicare and 13% through Medicaid, which, you know, every critical access hospital is different. And I think interestingly, and I don't have, this is more kind of do a data analysis, but for a larger critical access hospital, your Medicare and Medicaid percentage is higher than some of the other larger critical access hospitals I work with. Some of the other large ones that I say in your same peer group size have a lot more commercial than you guys do at Jefferson Healthcare. So interesting. The smallest of the small critical access hospitals have really high Medicare usually percentage. Couple other notes. I'm going to go small here while I get this. The CARES Act, we've talked about that. I don't think we need to spend any time there. And then I was going to jump ahead. So that's the core of the financial statements. And then it gets into what kind of the single audit section. And you get to the second of the three auditors' reports, which is where we report on internal controls over financial reporting and compliance. This is the government auditing standards requirements. It's required, this reporting and auditing standards are effective apply to you because you're a public hospital district in the state of Washington, and that's how you're audited. The main takeaway from this one is there's no findings, there's no material weaknesses or significant deficiencies in your internal control. So what you would want and hope it says. And then the next one, the third auditor's report, is narrower in scope. This audit report is just focused on federal awards. It's the single audit report, or the report required by uniform guidance for terminology. And whenever you have more than $750,000 of federal awards, a single audit is required. Last year, Jefferson Healthcare had a single audit because of the FEMA funding. This year, it's because of the Provider Relief Fund. And in 2022, you'll also need a single audit because of the Provider Relief Fund. And actually, you'll probably be getting a single audit kind of for quite a while, because in 2022, the USDA funding, even loans that you have that are guaranteed or through the USDA, haven't required to be included in the federal awards as a single audit, but starting in 2022, they will be. So you'll have a single audit probably for a while, as long as you have those USDA loans. And so that'll be a little bit, you just kind of get used to these extra reports. Even though that's a pretty straightforward and low risk type of audit procedure, it still will be out there. And so going through this, there is one finding related to the single audit on the Provider Relief Fund, and I will get to it in a couple seconds it might be the next, where are we at here? I keep alluding to it, I'll just get to it. And so there is a finding, and not that I want to like minimize the reason there is a finding, but the finding is essentially due to the guidance being very unclear on how to report lost revenue back when the reporting needed to be done last summer. And interestingly enough, I've completed three audits in the last couple of weeks, and all three of them have this same finding, because it was when you do the lost revenue calculation of budgeted revenue to actual revenue, it asks for six quarters of data. And so it was all of 2020, and it was the first two quarters of 2021. Well, the budget that was approved prior to March 27th, 2020, like it needed to be, is only for calendar year 2020 and not for calendar year 2021. And they recognized that they kind of didn't really make this real clear of what budget to use in the 2021 time period. And so organizations either use the 2020 budget again, or like you guys did use the 2021 budget there. But technically, there is no budget that could be used in that second time period. It was kind of a catch-22 in the whole process here. And they realized it kind of late that there was the third option, that if you wanted to use the budget to actual method through the whole reporting period, you should switch to this other alternative reasonable method. And so confusion, wrong budget, used technically for the two quarters of 2021 that were reported in the first reporting period. And it's easy to correct when you do your next reporting that's going to be required. HRSA recognized the issue, and the new instructions for lost revenue reporting almost center exclusively around how to change your reporting method from option two, which you did, to option three, which is any other reasonable method. And so they kind of recognized that almost, you know, anybody that chose that method's probably got to somehow fix it. And so it's easy to fix, and it's not going to impact any amount of provider relief funding you ever get to get or retain, because you have, in your guys's, in your situation, there was a lot of lost revenue, enough lost revenue in 2020 that will cover all of the provider relief funds that you've received. And even if it didn't, there's other expenses you could have claimed. So it has no effect. And this is a term I heard another CPA use. It's kind of a soft finding. That's not an official term, but it's a real finding, but it doesn't really have any like real implications. It's more like technical in a sense. And so for that, and Tyler and his team will work on fixing it and in the next reporting, and you're not the oiling organization that's going to have this finding. And HRSA has already recognized that a lot of organizations are kind of stuck in a bad spot with following the guidance that wasn't very clear, that later became clear, which was the whole journey through provider relief fund reporting for everyone. So I haven't reported a finding you guys in a long time. So it was like, spend a little time there. And then one of the last statements in here is the schedule of federal awards. It just shows where your federal funding comes from. The FEMA grant a little more this year, the provider relief fund funding, and then a little bit of kind of your SHIP grants and some of your other funding that you get. That should be there. That's the financial statements. Any questions on that?
Sounds like not.
All right. I'll move on to the second document, which is the letter of items that auditing standards require that we communicate, but the things that you as a governing board would want to know from your auditors. So it's kind of a laundry list of somewhat unrelated topics. And so the first part is if there were accounting policy changes, and there were no accounting policy changes in 2021. There will be in 2022 with that capital lease change that we talked about earlier as well. And then the document points out the significant estimates and financial statements, which in a hospital's case, in your situation, is the allowances for uncollectible accounts and contractual adjustments on patient accounts receivable, cost report settlements, and then the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund revenue recognition is a bit of an estimate as well. And then moving on, no difficulties in performing the audit, and actually went very smoothly. And I think, you know, we're a month or month. A lot of times we've presented in June and we're presenting in May. And I think even last year might've been July or August before we presented. But so that's an indicator that it went pretty smoothly. And I think Tyler, Sasha, and the rest of the finance team for it, working with them, all went nicely. It was good to say that. And then if there's material audit adjustments that are proposed by the audit team, auditors, we would need to let you know that. And there were no material audit adjustments that we proposed as part of the auditors. And that's, I think, is an important takeaway from this, because if your auditors are making material adjustments during the audit process, it makes you wonder a little more uncertainty about the information you're getting throughout the year. No material audit adjustments gives you more assurance that the monthly reporting and the other reporting you're getting is on track and helpful for what you need to do in your governing role. One thing, and I think we had this in there last year, is technically both the Jefferson Healthcare Foundation and the Hospice Foundation of Jefferson Healthcare are component units of the public hospital district because of their relationship and what you're essentially the sole beneficiary of those, is technically they're supposed to be included in the reporting entity scope of your organization. Very common not to include foundations, but it's also important for us to point out that they are technically supposed to be in there, but they're deemed not material to the public hospital district, you know, that you made that choice to exclude them and including them has pros and cons, depending on various factors. So that's the main takeaways in this letter. There is one more thing. And I know this one, and Tyler could probably agree, would agree to this, is there's a new requirement this year that part of that audit report change is now auditors are supposed to specifically communicate the significant risks we identify in audits and communicate that with you as the governing board. And we've always identified risks in audit. That's how you audit, is you identify risks. And there's standard is you're always going to a given risk that as auditors, we always identify as management override of controls. And then there's always going to be a risk, at least one risk related to revenue recognition. So it looks like we're pointing out risks, and it's like the first time that's ever been there, and that could be taken as a kind of a negative thing. But we've always done this. Now we just have to communicate that externally, which did test our skills as writers to present those, you know, externally. When you're only doing internal document, it's not communicating. That's been the big thing for us. But so that's new. We've always done that. But there it is. And last is the financial indicators report. And let me get this in the right size here. And we include this as part of the, it's more of just a byproduct of the audit. It's visual, gives trends, relationships. So it's what do your numbers mean to the size of your organization? And then there's some benchmarks of, you know, they're always a few, a year to a year and a half old, but some benchmarks to similar sized and similar situated hospitals to compare to. And also we started, we requested this a couple years ago, and we started doing this is grabbing some comparisons of total margin, operating margin, and days cash on hand for similar size critical access hospitals and one smaller not critical access hospital, just for some comparisons. And as you'll see through, as I think I say this every year, every hospital has its own story. There's uniqueness, especially when you start to go from state to state and community, and then even beyond that, community to community. But you can see, you know, Jefferson Healthcare and net patient service revenues, you know, right up there towards the top size on all of these, and as a big critical access hospital. And you can see the states and then the net patient service revenue for relativity. So there's a chart that's going to show your comparison to that as well. So first, yours, total margin 5.2%, and you know, generally in the 3-6% range is where a hospital needs to be for financial sustainability, and where Jefferson Healthcare has been for, you know, on average for most years. So, and you can see the comparison to some of the benchmarks there. And then you look at total margin for those however many letters H gets you to hospitals, 8, 9, 10 hospitals. What your main takeaway from this can be is that a larger critical access hospitals, when you go to critical access hospital conferences, or there's a lot of difference from a larger critical access hospital and its financial viability, and it is from the smaller critical access hospitals that you probably saw a couple weeks ago when you were in Walla Walla. Is the program in the state of Washington works pretty well, that larger critical access hospitals are pretty financially viable, and while the smaller ones is still more of a struggle. And you can see that, you know, kind of, and that all includes COVID relief that everybody got, and it generally was a pretty good year for the more mid-sized hospitals, larger critical access hospitals. Operating margin, you can see that bounce back to where you as an organization want it to be, in that positive 3-6% range. Last year was the anomaly with COVID, obviously, and then some medians there. And then you can see the operating margins here as well. And you can see that, you know, some that are pretty high, some that are pretty similar, a couple that are negative. And the one that's negative in the middle is a PPS hospital, so they don't get the benefits of the critical access hospital program. And this one, I don't know why I should stop including this, because they're an outlier, and then they're in a place with an incredible amount of tax revenue. And so they don't operate. They operate with a little more mission driven than they have to be financially viable from their operations. It's good to be where there's oil, is maybe their for tax base, at least for now. And then days cash on hand is how much cash, obviously how many days expenses you could pay with the cash on hand. And you can see that your comparison to the prior years. I think put a little caveat on the 174, there was the Medicare accelerated payments, which were kind of like a line of credit that represent about 24 days of your cash. So about 150 days of cash on hand, if you look at it that way. And then the next one, is that comparison to the other hospitals. And you can see actually reserve-wide, you actually have more than some of the other hospitals. And you can see that the one that had the really low I got to take them out of the comparisons because they're such an outlier, is they also have a lot of cash, all 90 days is the minimum you want to be at. And then 180 starts to be the next thresholds you want to be at and building, and depending on where you are in capital needs and the like. Then moving on, current ratio, anything above 2 is good. Trying to get this sized right. Capital expenditures, you didn't really spend a lot on capital equipment last year in 2021. What these mean is that anything above 100% means that the organization spent more on capital equipment than its depreciation was that year. So are you replacing equipment roughly the same pace you're theoretically using it up? It's not a perfect one-to-one ratio, and you want to, in any one year by itself doesn't tell a whole story. So you kind of look at the trends over time. Then long-term debt to capitalization, no new debt, paying debt, positive bottom line, the debt to equity ratio is changing, it's lower and lower. Days in net patient accounts receivable, how fast you're collecting your patient accounts receivable, been pretty consistent the last few years, and seeing mid-30s to mid-40s is the range of where you would, you know, most, you know, organizations that are good in the revenue cycle are. We see some in 60s and 70s still occasionally, so keeping that in mind. And then gross days, again, very, actually about as consistent through the years as I've seen anywhere. There's always seems to be some system conversion that people have that changes it around quite a bit, but consistent. Contractual adjustments as a percentage of payer of gross revenue. This is how much Medicare, Medicaid, and other commercial payers do not pay as a part of your standard charge. And again, really consistent through the years that about half of your standard charge is paid by your third-party payers. Bad debt as a percentage of net patient service revenue, you can see it went up a little bit. I mean, some of that, you know, policy and collections there of not collecting as aggressively during the COVID by, as a matter of policy. You can see that percentage. And as you get other, some of these ones that are other states, not all states have expanded Medicaid like the state of Washington. I know that still quite, it was quite a few years ago that happened, but bad debt is actually very different from state to state based on just how the Medicaid programs work from state to state. And then bad debt in charity care as a percent of gross patient revenue, actually relatively consistent through the years, up a little bit in 2021. Full-time equivalents, how many people work in the organization. This just includes employed FTEs, and the largest cost of an organization is just from the growth of the organization as the scope of services you provide is the growth in people as well. And then how much does each person cost on average, including all physicians, all nurses, housekeeping, techs, everybody. It's a very aggregate number. It includes the benefits as well. And then net patient service revenue per FTE, a really broad measure of productivity. You can see it took the little dip in 2020, but now back on the upward trend that it was before as well, as you would expect. And so that Did I stop sharing? Yeah. Any questions? I think when you go through the financial indicators, you see very, you know, positive financial results, and then the one finding that was kind of an outlier type of situation, and otherwise none of the, you know, other issues in the audit.
Laurie, it looks like you have a question.
Yes, Tom, with the comparison hospitals that you showed us, do we have the highest percentage of Medicare, Medicaid?
You know, when I was preparing for this, I started to think that would be interesting to know, and I don't really know off the top of my head. I would guess if not the highest, you're at least on the higher tier. A couple that I'm more familiar with in that graph, I know are less. I mean, there's at least, I should have kept Tina so I could remember who was who, but.
Somewhat constraining, you know, there's a limit to how much
revenue
we can get unless we have more commercial payers, right?
Right, exactly. I don't know if there's a certain magical point, but there's a certain point with your commercial payers are where you have, where any hospital makes any profit it has. And in a sense, when you're 60, 70% Medicare and Medicaid, that's exactly break even at best. And so any margin has to come from tax revenue, non-operating revenue sources, and those commercial payers, you know, less patients that don't pay. And so you're right. The ones that have 30, 40% commercial payers are in a better way. And yet it even matters what kind of commercial payers they have. Some pay better than others in the contracts they have.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Okay, sounds good, sir.
Case?
I love you.
Okay. Case, you're muted.
I know. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thanks, Tom. Very interesting report. Very good report. I'm just amazed at how well we do on these audits and how thoroughly you do them. When I was reading all of the financial pages, I actually found the section on pages 17 and 18 that talks about the long-term debt, capital lease obligations, revenue bonds, and all to be fascinating, because I'd actually never taken the time to sort of understand how much do we have out in revenue bonds, how many do we have, where are we in the payment cycle on those, and as I understand it, we have an awful lot more in terms of revenue bonds than we have in our long-term general obligation bonds. And it's those bonds, the LTGO bonds, are those the ones that produce our, that go to property taxes in the community? Am I reading that correctly?
That's great. I'm glad you asked. That's a good question. And is revenue bonds are paid through operations. So there is limited tax general obligation bonds are secured by your regular M&O levy. So the levy you get, and you don't really have that big of a regular M&O levy. So only so much of your debt can be secured with your regular M&O. Unlimited tax general obligation bonds, which you currently don't have any, those are the ones that are supported by a specific citizen approved levy, a special levy just for those. And so that's when your community decides that they want to levy another tax, and that's unlimited tax. And why it's called unlimited tax is because the voters have said we're going to tax ourselves until this debt is paid off. And so it becomes the lowest risk debt to a bondholder, because Jefferson Public Hospital District will tax until it pays it off. And limited tax are pretty secure in their own right because Jefferson County can continue the tax on your behalf to at least pay those off. And then while revenue bonds become the less secure to a bondholder because you have to operate and actually make, you know, generate cash flow to pay. So that's the three levels you tend to see is unlimited, special approved voter levy, limited, the regular M&O levy, and then revenue bonds and really everything else is from operations.
So when I look at my own property taxes and I see a line that says Hospital District Number 2, GO Bond 2013, and then it says non-VO. So is that the...
Non-VO, non-voter approved, yeah.
So I'm confused because wouldn't that be the one that went to the voters?
I don't... See, that's what's interesting. I the 2013 bonds are limited tax general obligation. And
okay.
And so I think it's just been clear more in your public hospital district and your county's case, more clearly assigned that regular levy was going as security for that limited tax general obligation bond.
Okay. But
it is unique because I think that, what were the other words you said, non-voter, because it's not voter approved. That's just the levy that you guys can, you decide on your own. Yeah.
Yeah. The other one says Hospital District Number 2 General.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the voter one. Yeah. But I do want to point out, just in case you are curious, that when you look at the property taxes, I'm looking at mine here in Port Townsend, less than 1% of the property taxes I pay go to the hospital district.
Yeah.
In fact, it's like 0.2%. And so we tax this community precious little for the availability of services that we offer.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments? Well, that was a very fine report. Thank you again for your thoroughness. I agree with Case that it's an excellent report, and thank you to our team, Tyler and Mike, of course. He leads the whole thing. So is there anything that you folks would like to say, Mike or Tyler?
Yeah, I'll just quickly say, we appreciate the work that Tom and Alana and the rest of the team do at DZA. They do a good job of keeping us honest, and they're good partners to work through as we do have questions throughout the year and bounce ideas off of them to make sure that, you know, we're doing things appropriately, you know, January through December, instead of waiting for the audit time and then going through and having to go through it. So it's a good partnership that we have with them, and we appreciate their support and thoroughness at the audit. And we are, even though it's Tom called a soft finding and it was based on a technicality, we are still very disappointed that we had that. And, HRSA guidelines, as he mentioned, were kind of ever changing and convoluted from the start, which happens when you're trying to get money out to folks as quickly as possible. And so we ended up with a mistake that others did as well, but we're still not happy about it, and we'll continue to find ways to do better.
Thank you, Tyler. Thank you for great work, and also it's nice to hear that you are aware of it and want to do better, but in the scheme of things, the drop in the bucket, you way up.
Maybe HRSA should have a finding.
Mike, is there anything that you'd like to add?
Nope, just thanks to Tyler and his team for good effort, and once again to Tom for I think a real detailed but completely understandable presentation. So thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Howard.
Thank you, Tom. And again, great report. Thank you for all your hard work over the years, too. It's been a long, great relationship.
Thank you. Well, thanks, everyone. See you later.
Thank you.
Good rest of the meeting.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Is there anything anybody would like to comment on beyond that? Otherwise, if not, then we can break. We can go ahead and go into a break and come back at 3:30.
I would just like to thank Tyler and his crew for the excellent job they do day in, day out to keep us in this good position. And as I said just now, I think HRSA should have the finding, not us. If they can't be explicit in their instructions, then maybe. But anyhow, thank you, Tyler and Sasha and everybody else who does such good work down there.
I second that because, you know, Tom couldn't write a good audit without the work that Tyler and his crew did. They did all the work. He just reported on what they did. So.
Yep. You know, Tyler, my brother was a CPA partner with PricewaterhouseCoopers. So I do have a little inkling about your department, even as a nurse.
So,
and congratulations. And none of us want your job.
Great job all the way around. Okay, let's go ahead and break then, and we will return at 3:30. Welcome back to the business portion of the May 25th, 2022 Jefferson County Public Hospital District Number 2 Board of Commissioners meeting. We will have an executive session towards the end of the meeting. The reason is to discuss the lease or purchase of real estate. So right now we begin with a patient story from our Chief Nursing Officer, Tina Toner. Welcome, Tina.
Hi, welcome. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Wait for that presentation. Thank you, Brittany. All right. I always enjoy sharing a thank you like this that just really showcases a patient's experience through multiple departments interacting with multiple team members. So we got a letter in, and I'll read that now. I came to the Jefferson Healthcare Facility ER and was admitted for an inflamed gallbladder. My gallbladder was removed that day, and I spent 2 nights there. I was constantly impressed by the high level of care I received during that time. I was visited by a multitude of hospital staff. Everyone communicated who they were, why they were seeing me, and listened to my concerns. They were professional and caring. I can't express how impressed I was with the level of care I received and how secure I felt. I wish I could name all the individuals who provided my care because each of them, the surgeon, x-ray tech, the nurse, medical assistant, patient navigator, respiratory therapist, all those who drew my blood so many times, and so many others contributed to my well-being. I truly appreciate the depth of care I received and how personalized my care was delivered. And so I want to really thank all of those teams and all of those team members that made that experience so wonderful for our patient. And I wanted to take just a moment to talk through one of those departments, which is our surgery department. If we can go to the next slide, Brittany. Something that wasn't mentioned in this case is that it happened after hours, which as the pandemic has went on, this is something we continue to see more of, which is an increase in unplanned surgical cases. And we think that's likely due to a combination of delayed surgical care throughout the pandemic and people back out living their lives and some of those things that happen when we're living our lives and having fun. So this slide here shows the case numbers per month since January of 2020 through April 30th of 2022. when we talk about the roller coaster of COVID, I mean, I think this department really has ridden the ups and downs and has continued to adjust again and again to meet our patients' needs. You'll see that dip at the beginning here of 2020, in the spring of 2020 when COVID began, and then we had the proclamation from the governor. Again, in the late summer of 2021, when we were supporting the inpatient surge and Delta, and then the last dip that was in January and February of 2022 with Omicron, and again, we were within a governor's proclamation limiting non-urgent cases. During these dips, our surgery team split their time between the cases that still needed to continue and in helping support other areas. At the beginning of the pandemic, that was supporting entrance screening. And in the middle of the pandemic, it was supporting the inpatient units and standing up a monoclonal clinic and staffing the monoclonal clinic. So they stayed busy during that time. When the proclamation ended in February, we had a backlog of about 160 patients, and we've been working really hard to get those patients scheduled and to catch up on that backlog. Even with those fluctuations, you can see the growth and I think increasing need for surgical care in our community. In 2020, our average cases per month, 163. 2021, 195, and 2022, 188. If you so far, if you exclude January and February, our case average is 210. So that's continuing to increase. And then another factor is the minutes of our cases. So the average minutes is an indicator of us performing more complex cases. In 2020, those were 13,724 minutes per month. 2021, 16,296. And then in 2022, 14,349. But again, if you exclude that January and February as we're starting out this year, the average is even higher at around 17,000. And so it'll be interesting to see where we end this year. Going to the next slide, I want to go back to the unplanned surgical cases. This is a snapshot of how often our call team is utilized, and this report shows cases that happen after the scheduled surgical day. So the cases that happen in the evenings and on the weekends are emergencies that we have very little control over. But as we've seen that number rise, we've been focusing on how to manage the things that we can control and managing the schedule closely for our daily surgery schedule. And this is an important piece because many of our off-hour minutes can be those cases that hold over at the end of the day when surgery day runs long. And so you'll see on this slide kind of that 2 and 3 p.m. hour, that darker yellow, are those cases where we have the most often cases running into our off-schedule time. And the work that we're doing on the schedule really helps that, which allows us to really support our teams and keep our callback time to the times that we need it for the emergencies and for caring for our community during those times. Just another, if you go to the next slide, Brittany, just another way of looking at it. This graph shows our cases on each day of the week. So on the top, 2020, then 2021, and then looking at these first 4 months in 2022. And you can see here how much more stable that daily schedule is in 2022. And what that does is, again, it minimizes that time, that holdover time at the end of the day, but it allows us to have more consistent time within the day for when emergencies happen and just being able to manage that more closely. Beyond the schedule, we've done some other things to really impact this. We are focusing on improving turnover time between cases. We've expanded the sterile processing role to allow for more assistance in the ORs. And we have an operations and scheduling team that are working on this every month, really improve the communication. And then we have a lot of just everyday heroes stepping up. We have staff that do little things to, you know, make sure their room is stocked so that if someone gets called in the night, they get home that much sooner. And our EVS team goes above and beyond trying to help support the turnover time. We've even had situations where we've had a provider, you know, come in on their day off because we've had a case to do. We've had a room available. We've had the staff, but we have a provider still tied up. So we've had a provider come in to make sure that happens. So just an all in all great work from all of our team and trying to support each other. Going to the next slide, Brittany, just a big thank you to all of them. Donica, who's been serving as our interim director of surgery, all of our surgeons, CRNAs, our EVS team, our surgical techs, our nurses, all of them, just a big thank you for all you do. And thank you for being there when our patients need you, whatever time that might be.
That is amazing. I had no idea how much of a scheduling process that is, and how dedicated. I've known they're dedicated, but this just goes above and beyond to help our community. It just really does my heart good.
Thank you
to everyone. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. Is there any other comments?
I'd say just tremendous team, the whole operating crew, and the the support and I'd say encouragement, but from the ED, patients coming through the ED, needing surgery, going to surgery, I mean, taking care of respiratory therapy, the whole gamut. Having been one of those people, but not fortunately, quite a few years ago now, I experienced that, and they're terrific, unbelievable.
Thank you.
Thank you for such an uplifting day, and thank you to our entire staff for all the work that you do. Our community is in good hands. Thanks. Any other comments? Okay, then. We will now look at the minutes from April 20th, special session. Is there a move to approve?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
So,
all right, all in favor, yeah. Please raise your hand. Okay, that looks like unanimous to me. We'll now do required approvals. And is there anything that any commissioner would like to discuss separately from the required approvals?
Straightforward and, for me.
Okay, may I have a motion to approve then, please?
So move.
All second.
Okay, any discussion? Okay, all in favor, raise your hand, please.
Aye.
Okay, it's unanimous. Patient advocate. Jackie Levin, our patient advocate, are you there? You are. We're happy to have you and welcome, and we're anxious to hear your report.
Thank you. Thanks, Brittany. So we're going to be looking at quarter one of 2022. We can go to the next slide. And as we saw last quarter, we're focused on our service excellence goal number 5, improve the patient experience. And this quarter, I'm going to be focusing on the work that we call our navigation process. It's a little bit different than what happens when a patient concern comes in, a grievance comes in. And so I just want to focus sharing what that process looks like. So next slide. So when we're navigating patient concerns, we're always listening. We are hearing how we might be demonstrating our accountability for what occurred. We also looked for ways that the patient can have more agency and so their own accountability in what occurred, if that is appropriate. We do that through inquiry. The organization supports transparency, which is really a pillar of this work. And then we look to what are the possibilities for improving this particular situation, a care gap, a process that needs improvement. Next slide. So here's our service feedback, our concerns, people offering compliments, and the percentage of suggestions and questions we get. And as you can see, the dark blue line is the current quarter and the light blue line is last quarter. And you can see it really everywhere. The numbers have gone down for concerns. This isn't the overall number of contacts, but for the concerns. And that that the numbers are small. So if you look at cardiology, it looks like it made this big leap. But, you know, for last quarter, it had one concern, and this quarter it had three concerns, and so it's not like a huge number. It just kind of jumps out as a shift. In terms of our feedback summary averages, it took us 1.57 days to, on average, to send an acknowledgement letter out. It took us 11.41 days for us to close, and there were four concerns that took greater than 30 days. So overall, there was just a slight increase from the number of contacts from last quarter. 12% were compliments, 7% were suggestions or had a question, and 82% offered our opportunities for improvement. And the list is there of provider concerns, COVID protocols, access and transitions and communication. Any questions so far? Okay.
I think that's a good point when you mentioned that how small the numbers are to keep that in context. That's
yeah.
So true.
And next slide. Yeah, so over the years, Amy and I have been separating out what are true patient concerns that would be a grievance and work it through our grievance process, and others where patients are just needing help navigate our system. And sometimes, you know, they can be a kind of in both realms, but I want to walk you through that we've been recently deciding to track this type of process that we do, this navigation work. And we started in mid-February, so the data here is missing the first 6 weeks of 2022. And we're tracking what's the process that was, or the procedure that was showing a difficulty or a gap, where was the location, and how much time did we spend, we're estimating, on getting to a resolution, just to see, you know, how our time is being spent. And so for quarter one, starting in February 16th for the data collection, we had 70 contacts with people. It took approximately 70 hours for the two of us, not 140 hours, with the two of us, 70 hours. And these are the areas of concern that we found were popping up. And
Jackie?
Yes.
There's one typo. It should be March 31st, 2022, I believe, instead of
2020. Oh, you're right. Thank you. I'll make that correction.
Okay.
Thanks. So any other questions or comments? You know, I mean, time is changing, so maybe we are going backwards. I'll make that correction. Next slide, please. So a couple weeks ago, I received a call from a patient. This was a concern that took place at a screening station. The patient had answered yes to the the exposure question, which is, have you been exposed to somebody with tested positive to COVID in the last 10 days? She was turned away from the hospital and her appointment, and then she made the call to the patient advocate office. And the overall process took four leaders collaborating. We had a successful outcome for the patient, new learning and support for the screeners, and took about 70 minutes. And I'm going to walk us through that. So the patient called around 3 o'clock. I took this call. I was listening and made a promise to the patient that I would call her back by the end of the day with some information for her. Whether if I had no information, I'd still call her back with that information, or if I had some better information, she would receive that. So the first thing I do is I review what's our current policies for COVID and screening and access to the hospital. And I also know that we're using the health department COVID testing flow sheet. So I also reviewed that. And the next thing I did was go down to the department to speak to the director to say, you know, what's your take on this flow sheet, and should this patient have been allowed to have her visit? I also then left a message for Laura Showers, our infection preventionist. And before she even called back a few minutes later, our patient access supervisor, Christina Comley, knocked on my door saying she knew about this concern. So Christina sat down with me and Laura Showers called back. We had a three-way conversation, reviewed the policies, we reviewed the Department of Health flow sheet, and we discussed process change and needs options for this particular situation and potential future ones that would arise. So next slide. So what we came up with, that at 4 p.m. a new process was outlined and next steps were confirmed with the three of us, that this COVID testing flow sheet would be available and printed every week. So it would be an up-to-date COVID flow sheet and placed at each of the screening stations. The question, have you been exposed in the last 10 days, is not really a current question. But the flow sheet walks the patient through. The screener doesn't have to necessarily make this decision. It's, you know, are you symptomatic? No. Were you exposed? Yes. Were you within 6 feet and less than 15 minutes in the space with this person? Yes. Are you fully vaccinated? Yes. Have you received a booster? Yes. Quarantine not necessary. Wear a mask. And so they're also, you know, allowing that these screeners can also contact somebody, you know, from the department as well to help make this decision if it seems confusing or not clear. But in the end, we feel like we were able to give our screeners another tool and patients a way to review this. We've gotten a couple of calls that relate to this. Patients are familiar with this flow sheet, and so they are reviewing it and using it to help make their determination of what they should be doing. I think that's it for my slides. Any questions regarding this? So within 70 minutes, the patient was called back. There is a new process in place. Four leaders came together to help make some decisions and a new process now.
I have a question. Was the patient satisfied with the outcome?
Yes, very much appreciated. And we also expressed our appreciation for her bringing this to our attention.
Okay, any questions for Jackie?
Well, just I want to comment that I think the studies show that a patient who initially is dissatisfied with something and then has a satisfactory outcome is even more likely than a patient who's been satisfied from the get-go to say something good about the institution. And so this is one of those win-win-win situations for all of us.
Okay, any other questions or comments? All right. Jackie, does that conclude your...
Yep, that's it. If any, yep, if you have any questions afterwards, I will make that update on the slide so Brittany can send out an updated PowerPoint to you all.
Are those, is that template that you had available online so that someone can read it if they have
the COVID, yeah, the COVID testing flow sheet?
Yes.
It's if you just go to the Port Townsend Department of Health website and put in COVID, there'll be a link to this PDF. And they say they're updating it every couple of weeks.
Great. Thank you, Jackie. Thank you for your report.
Thank you.
Very good. Okay, then we will move on to our quality report from our Chief Patient and Safety Officer, Brandy Manuel. Brandy, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I am joining you from a campground without great service, so I'm going to keep my video off so that the sound stays on. Brittany, next slide, please. All right, so we are going to do a quick flyover our four main buckets under the quality pillar of our strategic plan, and then we'll take a look at the latest star ratings, which were just published last week, and drill down into our core measures a little bit. And as always, we will take a look at what our patients are telling us, and then we'll do a review of projects and focus areas. Next slide. All right, so here is our 2022 strategic plan under quality. And most of the areas where we see yellow here are actually things that are new this year or restarting this year and are actually making really great progress. So looking at the deployment of process improvement tools, our Performance Improvement Council is launching next month, and this month we'll be meeting one-on-one with our leaders to take a look at their quality work, to identify their current performance improvement plans, and begin to standardize the tools that we're using across the house to improve quality in all different areas. So that's looking really good. Under enhancing our data infrastructure, just something of note, our data team, you know, looking at Tina's report, which is so cool to see the work of our surgical services team. And you know, a couple of years ago, it would have been really hard to articulate that story were it not for the work of our data team. And so we're continuing to work with that team so that our leaders can better tell their stories and share the good work that they do. So in the last couple of weeks, we centralized our data analysts into one department. And we now have a formal data and analytics department led by Dunya Pho, and they're doing just incredible work and working on even more automation technology, looking at the ways in which we deliver information to our leaders to better support them in the work that they're doing, and just really excited about all of that. And the team is incredible. So wanted to call that out. And then otherwise, everything is looking good. We're going to take a look at the core measures here in just a minute. We did have one patient fall, unfortunately, last month with mild temporary harm. The patient did okay, but had gotten out of bed without calling for assistance and unfortunately fell. And then just of note, you know, one of the things that struck home for me in listening virtually to the WISHNA conference was just the work around high reliability and how important culture is in keeping our patients safe. So this year we are due to do another culture of safety survey, which we generally do in about the fourth quarter. So we'll be seeing more information about that in the next few weeks. Next slide, please.
Brandy, could you, a quick question on here.
Yeah.
Could you explain what the different colors mean?
Yes.
Targets.
Great, great question. So the green just means we're at or above where we hope to be. Yellow means that we're just under or we're building up. So for things that are process measures, like having performance improvement plans in place, those are the things that we're building a process for, and we have made good momentum towards. And then the pink or the salmon colors are where we are not meeting our target, where it's far off. So if you're goal is zero cases of harm. One, you know, in this example, we had one case of harm, so that made it pink. In looking at up in the top bucket where it says greater than 90% closure rate of our environment of care reported items, we're currently significantly under that. So it's around 50, it's just south of 60% right now. The EOC committee is working on a plan to really help support our leaders across the organization to keep those front of mind and create a feedback loop so that we can get those closed in a more timely way. So we've got good momentum on that as well. And then down below, the other pink one is under learning culture. And it's around a goal around having a very ambitious goal of having 80% of our leaders certified in team steps. We've had a lot of transitions in the last couple of years within our leadership team and lots of new leaders, which is great, but it means that we have a bit of a gap in their training for team steps. So we have a lot of work to do in that area, but we're excited to pick that up again this year. It took a little bit of a break through COVID, but we're picking that back up this year.
Thank you.
Yeah. Next slide, please. Thanks for the question. All right. So our star ratings came out last week, and CMS annually will publish star ratings for organizations. It's a bit dated, so it's typically for the year prior. So what we're looking at is July 2020 through 2021, which is right in the middle of COVID. And where we landed was a 4-star overall star rating, and then a 5-star experience of care rating. So that's very good. National average is 3 and 3. So we are ahead of the game in both overall star rating and experience of care. And then just because we like to see what others are doing and how they're doing, we, in taking a look at other hospitals around us, Whidbey is a 2 and a 4. OMC is a 4 and a 4. Prov Everett is 3 and 3, Skagit is 2 and 3, and Harrison is 3 and 3. So I guess the moral of the story is if you're going to need to seek care, you should do it on the peninsula because we do a really great job. Mm-hmm. And people often ask sort of what goes into that magic rating, what goes into that box? And it's all of the stuff that I have listed on this slide. Dunia and I have started brainstorming some fun ways that we can create some dashboards and drill down and just have more regular reports of sort of our own internal star rating. And so I'm excited to see where that can go. But what you see here and sort of the differences in the color of what we've got here, blue means that Jefferson Healthcare's performance was the same as other hospitals. So not really better, not really worse, just kind of the same. The heart failure was the only, the heart failure and the ED throughput, as we've talked about before, we scored worse than the national performance. And then the areas in green were areas where we outperformed the national rates. So overall, really good performance. Again, this is about a year old. Unfortunately, our safety scores, so some of the scores you see are in gray. It's because either we didn't have enough cases or because it was something that CMS didn't count for. And during COVID, they went ahead and kind of put a pause on some of the reporting pieces. So unfortunately, we generally do really, really well in those areas. And had they been included, it's quite possible that we would see 5 stars on our overall rating instead of 4. But we will still continue to measure it. We will still continue to report it. And we will still continue to take great care of our patients.
Next, and is this actually done by CMS or do they contract it out?
It is done by CMS through our reporting and our claims data. So some of it is based on our reporting or chart audits and our submission of data. And then others are based on our claims data. So like the readmissions and the mortality rates, for example, are based on claims data. Any other questions? There's a lot packed onto this slide.
I would personally love to see a very simple table that gives the rating of other healthcare institutions in the region.
Oh, with their star ratings?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can do that. We'll get that to you. Next slide, please.
Brandy, can I ask you, is it online through CMS?
Yes, if you go to CMS Hospital Compare and then look under hospitals, you can look up any hospital that you'd like, either by entering the zip code, the name of the organization, or the town that you're looking for, and it'll bring that up. It's public information.
Thank you.
Yeah. So one of our big dots that we look at, you know, the two big dots, as we call them, that go into that overall rating are readmissions and mortality rates. And so because the data that we get from CMS is pretty dated, like I said, a year old, and the more regular performance reports we get are about 9 months old, our incredible data team has created a dashboard to allow us to really drill into our own readmissions and track them. What you can see here is the first quarter of 2022, and you can see that the overall readmission rates have been decreasing, which is great. And then just below that, you can see the orange dotted line that represents the average days to readmission. So our goal is, of course, that people aren't being readmitted at all. But if they are, we certainly don't want to see people leaving the hospital and being readmitted right away. So it's actually a good thing that the lines are doing what they're doing, the overall rate decreasing and the days to readmission increasing. Right now, we're seeing an average days to readmission around 12.32, and our overall rate is 6%. The national average is right around 14%, and Washington State is just below that, around 12. They've actually come down a bit. And the nice thing about this particular report is it takes into consideration all of the hospitals in the I-5 corridor area that are using Epic. So we're able to pull in any Jefferson Healthcare patient who's been readmitted anywhere to a hospital that has Epic. That's not all hospitals, but it's many of them. So it gives us a better understanding than if we were just looking at readmissions from us to us.
Brandy, may I ask a question? Did the readmissions link to the reason that they were in the hospital in the first place, or are they just can they be readmissions for any other reason?
That's a great question. The answer is both. So what you're looking at right now is overall readmission for any cause. So if you happen to have say you were hospitalized for COVID, and then, you know, unfortunately you were in a bicycle accident and you broke your leg and you had to be admitted for that purpose, in theory, it would show up here as a readmission because it's still a readmission within 30 days. But on the slide that we saw previous to this one, there are certain conditions that they look at specifically. So things like heart failure, pneumonia, cardiac issues, AMI, those are all looked at. Hip and knee replacements are another one, so surgeries. And we also drill down in our dashboard. We have the ability to drill down and follow those as well. But this in particular is just looking at overall.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So if I may follow up on that, Brandy, so then does that affect our star rating with CMS?
It does.
The gallbladder out and then fell and broke their hip 3 weeks later.
It does. The one sort of reassuring thing about that is all hospitals are scored the same way and they all have kind of the same situation where patients may leave for one reason and be readmitted for another reason. So it is less about just a flat rate and more about how we do in comparison with everyone else. So in a way, we're all sort of skewed in the same way, I guess. That's a great question. Any other questions? All right, next slide, please. All right, sorry for the busyness here, but one of the things that goes under the efficiency of care is how well we perform on our core measures. And so I want to call out that this is first quarter data. It's not complete yet because that quarter, we're still getting records for that. So the quarter is not closed yet. So we should look at this as preliminary, but we do look at it pretty regularly. And you can see, generally speaking, we do really well. There are a couple areas in our stroke data where we had some fallouts. Those are really, really small numbers. And our team of clinical leaders are taking a look at these and are working on stroke care as their focus performance improvement work for this year. So we have some really good work going on with our inpatient team, with our rehab team, and with our providers to see how we can create more reliable systems so that we don't have these very small numbers impact us the way that we have. And then you can see here, we've got under elective deliveries, we do really well. So lower is better there. And we have been zero for a very long time. Our C-section rates are up a little bit. We talked a lot about this in our OB quality committee, and our providers are really, really engaged in better understanding kind of this information. But one of our providers raised a really great point that, you know, we don't generally just do C-sections just to do them. We do them because there's a clinical need to do them for either mom or baby. So a higher rate than expected, A, we have small numbers, so that's part of the reason. But B, it's because there was good clinical decision making that led to the decision to do a C-section. So we're watching that really closely. And that's one of the focus areas that the OB quality committee is looking really closely at. But I wanted to call it out because it definitely is looks like a bit of an outlier. And then the only other outlier here is really the ED throughput, which we've kind of talked about. Nationally, it's not as high as we see here, but across the state, there have been challenges in just emergency department boarding and being able to transfer patients in and out. And that has certainly impacted our throughput times for the last year and a half, at least, of COVID. Any questions here?
If I could just make a comment, I'm glad to see that the colonoscopy follow-up is good because, as you know, Brandy, I carried a sign at the Rhodey Parade as part of the Grand Marshal celebration that said, we did 1,300 colonoscopies in 2021, I think it was. And it got a lot of laughs and thumbs up and people saying, yes, I got mine. So
I would say that was the most commented on sign in the entire parade. I don't know. I had the pleasure of walking right behind that. And there were a lot of great comments about it. any other questions? All right. Next slide, please. All right. So as we always do, I like to share a little bit about how our patients are doing and what their perception of care was. And what we have here is our inpatient care. And the question is, would you recommend Jefferson Healthcare to your friends or family? The yellow line that you see across the top there represents the top quartile, which is what our goal is. And you can see that over the last couple of years, we've been right at that top quartile, even just above it in a couple of cases. First quarter looks like it's dipped down a bit, but again, and my eyes aren't good enough to quite see it, but if you look at the N is considerably smaller because that quarter has not closed out yet, and they'll still receive some surveys back. So that one still may toggle just a bit, but in general, just really great job. And some of the comments are off to the right, which mirrors what Tina talked about. It's really this great dance that all of our teams do to take such good care of our patients, our providers, our nurses, our therapists, the lab, our EVS staff, sort of everybody gets a mention in looking at the comments and are recognized. So my favorite comment here is best hospital experience ever. Glad I live in Port Townsend. So thanks to our care teams upstairs in the ACU and the ED too, that often is plays into this. And some of you may have seen, but we went live with our real-time surveys in the last month. So you may or may not have been the recipient of a survey. We did a little bit of a catch-up phase. So we went back a few weeks and we sent out texts and emails asking our patients for their feedback. And now moving forward, now that we did that one-time sort of cleanup, those will happen real-time in the moment. As soon as you basically leave your visit, you'll get either a text or an email asking how your visit was. Most of the surveys are pretty brief. And meant to be easier and less cumbersome than the paper surveys were. So far I've had great feedback and I'm hoping this is a good move for our patients, an easier way to give feedback. Any questions here before we? All right, next slide, please. And we'll wrap up with our focus areas. So we mentioned that the real-time surveys launched, which was a lot of fun to see that kind of take shape finally. We're working on leveraging MyChart in a different way to better connect patients with their care. We're looking at, instead of kiosks, which is kind of an older technology, well, we may look at kiosks, but we're also looking at how to use MyChart so patients can actually check in using MyChart without ever having to stop at the desk if they choose not to. They still could. That will always be a service, but we'll also look for other ways to allow patients to just more seamlessly navigate their care, which I think will be really exciting. We're also looking at other tools for patient engagement and service recovery. And in accreditation, we're due to submit our corrective action plan progress next, actually in July. And then we're expecting around the same time our next DND survey, which is for our infection control and prevention survey. We are planning on making application in the fourth quarter for our hip and knee certification. And that team is being led by Laura Showers and Kirsten Golden. And Dr. Eisman has been working really closely with that team as well, which has been really fun to see that take off. And then our internal audit program, currently we have a new trauma coordinator, Sandra Kelso, who's a registered nurse. She is she's been in the reserves and has done a lot of work overseas as a flight trauma nurse, and we are lucky enough to have her on our team. She is doing an internal audit of our program currently, and we'll be really looking forward to some good reports from her in the next while. And then I think the rest of it is all things that you have already seen, other than, as I mentioned, the Performance Improvement Council, which will begin in June. Next slide. All right, that's all I have. Any questions for you or for me?
I do have one question.
Sure.
How do we rate compared to other hospital districts with regards to the reports by patients about whether they would recommend care at the institutions? Do we have that information from other institutions?
We do. It would be for all, well, we could narrow it down by all hospitals or just by critical access hospitals. The slide that we showed there is about where we generally fall, which is in the top quartile. So top, kind of top performer bracket. And I would could definitely show that in next month's report if you'd like to see those comparisons, just to both overall hospital performance, and then if we wanted to drill down to smaller critical access hospitals, we could definitely show that.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And did I hear you say you were camping?
Indeed, yes.
Well, thank you for going above and beyond and taking time out of your camping trip, or maybe it's a relief. I don't know.
It's a privilege to get to be with you today and to share a little bit about what's going on. And also, I would be lying if I didn't tell you that I was sitting in my air conditioned trailer while my family's out in the heat. So it's a great excuse. Thank you.
The truth comes out. Thank you, Brandy.
Thank you.
Okay, then next is Tyler Freeman, our Chief Financial Officer, with the financial report. Tyler, welcome again.
Yep. Good afternoon. So we'll be going through both March and April because of the special session last month. We didn't have March financials done in time. So first, on the next slide, I have some financial policy updates that I wanted to make the board aware of. So the first one is our prompt pay discount that we offer. So previously, we had two different amounts. You either received a 20% discount if your account balance was 5,000 or less, and a 25% discount if your balance was 5,000 or greater. And the only exclusion was copays. So deductibles and coinsurance were allowed for the prompt pay discount. And that is, it can be a little bit of a problem. That can violate some managed care contracts. You can also get yourself into some trouble just by offering discounts to those that are insured. And so what we want to do is change that policy to mirror what other institutions do, where the prompt pay discount is for folks that do not have any insurance. So it would exclude copays, deductibles, and coinsurance, but we would be moving the percentage discount up from the two different paths to 25% flat rate for anybody. But that, as I said, if you look through the policies just of, you know, UW, anybody in the state, they're going to have it just for those self-pay patients. And the reason is you can get yourself into some trouble with your insurance contracts by having it otherwise. So this will protect us from having any issues down the road. And the collections policy on the next line. So give a little bit of background on this one too. So previously we were using a external collection party, HRG, to collect on our accounts, just to do the collection process altogether. And then we were sending accounts to collections to a firm called Audit and Adjustment if the external collection agency was not able to collect. We stopped that practice in March 20 of 2020 due to the pandemic. And we have also since then stopped contracting with HRG. So we have brought collections in-house. So we have our internal team reaching out to folks. They're the ones doing the collecting. And what we want to do is add Audit and Adjustment back into the mix, but not as a collection agency in the sense that we used to use them in the past, but as another level, almost similar to what HRG was doing, but after we have tried to collect on the account. So we just, with a internal team of about four folks, we don't have a lot of resources to track people down if we're not able to find them. And having an agency like Audit and Adjustment, they have more staff, they have better tools, they can reach out, they can connect with patients that we're unable to find, and offer them either payment plan, financial assistance. They would basically be doing the same collection practices that we would be doing. It's just that they have more tools and resources. So that soft collection process, there's no legal action taken. There's no impact to the credit report, none of that. It's basically just an extension of our internal collection agency or internal collection team. So we want to do that. We also want to change the policy. We had stated that if we sent any account to collections that we couldn't claim it as a Medicare bad debt. That's not something that CMS requires. So we've basically been shooting ourselves in the foot and not able to report as much Medicare bad debt to CMS. We've talked about that in the past. That's a big deal because if we are not able to send it to Medicare, that means that we're receiving $0 on that patient balance. Whereas if we're able to collect as a appropriate Medicare bad debt, they will pay us 65 cents on the dollar. So there's a big financial impact there if we're unable to. And so we want to change that policy to mirror what CMS allows us to do. And then lastly, there was a House bill that came through for charity care. You all will recall that our charity care policy is so generous that the House bill that increased the percentages didn't have any impact to us, but it still has some guidelines for asset testing that we just want to make sure that our language and our policy mirrors. And we also need to replace all references of charity care with either financial assistance or indigent care. And the reason for that is another CMS guideline you know, these policies are very, they have a lot of strict requirements, and the CMS has taken the stance that if you even reference it as charity care, then you can't claim it as a Medicare bad debt. So you have to call it something else. So financial assistance in, predominantly in indigent care is how we are going to change the phrasing of our policy so that we're able to claim all of the what is still charity care, but under a different name as a Medicare bad debt. So any questions on those?
Casey? Yep, I do have a question. Tyler, first of all, thank you for your explanations. Why were we not claiming things on the Medicare bad debt before? Was that because of the way we were handling the collections process?
I think so. We had a collections process that we basically just took anything that was collected by the collection agency, we just dumped in as a miscellaneous revenue instead of going through and applying it to the patient's account and then saying that we were unable to collect and here's the remainder that we need to get from CMS. So I think because of just the way that our processes were outlined, where we weren't doing the correct approach of saying we received money from audit and adjustment, this is the account it applies to, we still have money outstanding, we're not receiving any payment, we should claim it as a bad debt. Since we didn't have that clarity because of our internal processes, I think that's what led us to not do it. So we're changing those processes along with changing the policy.
So this really sounds like a win-win. I mean, it's the patients don't get sent to court at any time. We continue the soft collections process, and we can claim the bad debt.
Yeah, it's really especially posting it as a miscellaneous income is definitely not best practice. So this just gets us in line with best practice. It's still we have a probably the most generous charity care policy out of most hospitals in the state, and definitely out of critical access hospitals. And having that soft collection policy as the extension of us is probably probably less strict than others would be in terms of their collections as well. So we're still yep. trying to do things as patient friendly as we can while still collecting the money that we need to continue operating.
Well, I don't think it's important if you are approached at the co-op or the farmers market, I don't think it's important that you'll be able to walk them through the accounting of our bad debt. However, it is important because we are making a change that our community may notice, and it's important that you understand what we're doing and more importantly what we're not doing. If you think about the billing process of consisting of three phases. The first phase is you send the bill out, and then the second phase, and over the years we've either done it in-house or out of house. But we call and try to stimulate collection. And then the third phase is assigning that debt to a collections agency. And that's when credit report implications, you know, the legal steps that they feel they need to take in order to position themselves to collect. The new process is we send the bill out, and then we are outsourcing the as Tyler referred to it, soft collections part with a company who also does collections. So they are real good at having accurate databases, are able to perhaps locate a patient and help them sign up for charity care or anything else that they might be deserving of or eligible for. And they will make a handful of calls to to try to stimulate collections. However, and that when they conclude that process and determine either through collections or deem it uncollectible, that's when the process will stop, and there won't be any report or finding on a credit report or anything like that. So the distinction is, you might hear from someone that will swear to you that we are working with a collection agency because it's an organization that will represent themselves not as Jefferson Healthcare, but we're doing that because we are outsourcing that resource. We think that they can do a better job of that, identifying those parties who are able to pay us something. We think it's a better process, but nothing has changed with respect to our continuation of not sending people to a collection agency.
And is that the same company we have used before, or is this a different agency?
It's the same.
It's a group we worked with for several years ago, and you know they're a smaller regional firm, and we continued to use them because they seemed like they were a better fit in rural communities than maybe some of the larger firms.
And they're also allowing us to, you know, drive what that messaging sounds like with patient calls to do the soft collection. So they're being very collaborative in the ways in which that we want them to communicate with our patients.
Great. Would it be possible to get a very small paragraph that describes what you said? That might be helpful to remind us exactly how the wording would be best.
Yep, I can do that.
Thank you very much.
All right. And then if you want to skip ahead to the next slide, I won't spend quite as much time going through the finances just because we do have 2 months to get through, and you're probably financed out with hearing Tom's presentation too. So we'll go through the numbers as quickly as we can. But basically March, we had a fairly good operating month. January and February were low. March was a little bit of a bounce back. We weren't as impacted by proclamations, had a little bit of that pent-up demand that came through. And so numbers started to trend in the positive direction. But then on the next slide for April, I think we were spring break caused some issues. We probably just staffing outages as well. So, you know, we turned from a decent chunk of our stats in the green zone to a decent chunk of our stats in the red zone. So overall, there's a lot of them that are over the April 2021 run rate, but not many that were meeting budget as of the end of April for year to date. And that plays out in the income statement. So on the next slide, you can see March is 5% increase in gross patient service revenue, but still 5% below budget year to date. So even with that big bounce back, we're still digging ourselves out of that hole from January, February. Overall, change in net position, $832,000 for the month, and $1.3 million, almost $1.4 million year to date. So we were sitting over budget for net income at the end of March. But then on the next slide, April, we moved right back down. So 6% under budget for revenue. And still you can see down below to the operating expenses have been running, even while we've been less than our revenue budget, operating expenses for the month were pretty much right on pace, and year to date, a little over budget. So our expenditures haven't trended down with volumes, and some of that is just staffing overages, use of agency staffing agencies in some areas as well, just to try and get bodies in to be able to see the patients that we have. So $992,000 for net income year to date, lower than what we budgeted, but still almost double that of where we were April 2021. And April in 2021, we ended in a good spot. So while we're lower than we want to be, and we've seen that expense pressure and lower volumes than our expectations, that's not any different than the rest of healthcare right now. That's just kind of where a lot of places are at. And lucky for us, we had some CARES funding that we had socked away from last year to soften the blow, and still doing relatively well overall. And then you can also see on the next slide days cash, even though that top yellow line is continuing to go down as we're repaying the Medicare advanced loan, the actual cash net less the loan payback has been pretty flat, you know, at that 130 to 133 range. So even with our increase pressure on the margin, we've still done a good job of managing our cash and making sure that we're collecting on all of the accounts that we're sending out. So a flat cash number for declining operations is something I would take as a win. And then the board reports, we can probably click right through those. There's nothing really to note on the board reports. There are the expenditures for the audit isn't in there yet, but the election expenditures are. So the election expenditures are what you see on that other purchase service line. And then on the final slide, you can click through that one too. So May projection as of this morning is 97% of budget for charges, and we're still sitting in a pretty good spot for cash collections, considering that we're paying 50% of our Medicare is being withheld. So we're still collecting $371,000 per day for cash collections, and our days in AR is in a good spot too at 40 days. I blasted through that pretty quickly to save you all from, you know, too many numbers in one sitting, but are there any questions over either March, April, or May operations?
Okay, going once, twice. Okay, Tyler, thank you very much for the report, and well done. Looks like we're better off than we could be, that's for sure. Thanks, Tyler. Okay, now Mike Glenn, our CEO, your administrative report.
All right, thanks, Jill. Next slide, Britt. So I'm going to have a relatively brief presentation, and then Dunya is going to give an advocacy update, and there's a lot of work going on in that area. And then Dr. Mattern is back, and he will give a kind of a COVID and workplace challenge presentation, or workplace burnout update and presentation. The hospital operations, we have very high patient census today. It was 21 patients this morning, which is an uptick than what we have seen recently. Interestingly, zero COVID patients today, but we have seen kind of a usual pattern of one or two in the hospital. Probably the biggest challenge is difficult to discharge patients. And you need to understand that when we talk about a difficult to discharge patient, which is a label that that either WISHA or the state has given these patients, they are patients that require some degree of care that we are incapable of giving or not best suited to give, and sometimes that could be a patient who needs geropsychiatric treatment, and because of the acute shortage of bed availability in the state, that we take care of that patient, and sometimes those patients are ITA'd, sometimes they are not. But that also could mean a patient with developmentally disabled issues. It for one reason or another is disruptive in his or her current home setting, and is sent to the hospital for evaluation. And when that occurs, and the home setting it doesn't feel comfortable taking that patient back, that it is up to us to find a suitable discharge plan. And in some cases, even though maybe 12 hours into the stay, there is nothing medically driving that stay. So those are two ends of the spectrum, but they both result in very long efforts to try to find a suitable discharge site. And in our case, we haven't looked, as of last week, we had a patient over 70 days, a patient over 50 days, and then a couple of patients that we anticipated equally long lengths of stay. So earlier case mentioned the win-win-win. This is truly lose-lose-lose, because we are not a geropsych facility. That geropsych facilities are licensed because they have layers of support services that not only provide safe and quality care, which we're capable of providing safe care, but geropsych specific stimulation care. So it's not ideal for the patient. It's not ideal for the community because Jefferson Healthcare is a very expensive place to maintain a patient like this while we are seeking another discharge. And it's not ideal really from the hospital because it takes a bed that we may need and the staffing around it that we may need for a more acute care patient. So when we were really challenged during the Omicron variant, it was because we were dealing with both of these high levels of difficult to discharge patients aggravated by nurse assisted living centers and nursing homes with staffing shortages not able to admit, and upticks in COVID patient activity. At one point we had like six or seven COVID patients. So you add all that together, and you are looking at a census in the low to mid 20s. Today we're in the low 20s without any COVID patients, but I think we are acutely aware of the rising community prevalence. And even though we believe the hospitalization per the existing variant number of positives will be less than certainly we saw with Delta and probably Omicron, it's difficult to believe that there won't be a trail of hospitalizations that result from You know, I think the last time I looked, it was 850 positive cases per 100,000 population, which is a you know, crazy high number. So we, and because our employees live in that community, there's also staffing challenges resulting from exposures and kiddos coming home with COVID positive and infecting their parents who are employees of Jefferson Healthcare. So we are battening down the hatches for what will likely be a challenging 2 to 4 weeks. Hope that it won't be. I don't think the level of acute hospital activity will mirror what we have seen in other surges, but it's probably irresponsible not to prepare for some level of activity and also expect a kind of continuation of challenging staff availability times. Our outpatient services and ancillary services are kind of bouncing around, very busy in March, as Tyler's slide showed, not so busy in April. And I think a function of that is spring break, but another function is staff availability in some areas. Another transition you need to be aware of is we are transitioning from Radia as our radiology provider to Skagit Radiology as our full-time radiologist group. And the primary reason for that is Radia, due to lots of reasons, one being just the availability of radiologists, when our radiologist indicated he was going to resign and go back to Lincoln, Nebraska, they concluded that finding another radiologist to plan in our at Jefferson Healthcare the 5 days a week was going to be too difficult for them to contractually commit to. So they gave us notice, kindly agreed to continue to provide teleradiology services, which they continue to do, and that's, you know, 90% of the radiology reads approximately. And then Jake did a great job of contacting several other radiology providers, most of them having the same challenges, but Skagit Radiology indicated that they may have some short-term radiologist availability to help us, and then committed to recruiting a full-time radiologist to come to our community. Mm-hmm. So the transition related to personnel and company to company is one thing, but the transitioning from one interface to our electronic medical record, to their electronic medical record, and then these PACS systems, which are basically the electronic medical record for diagnostic imaging views, is an extraordinarily complex effort. And so Rob at our shop and Providence with Community Connect and Skagit Radiology and our PACS vendor put a work plan to accomplish that. So that work is going on. It is resulting in a gap in on-site availability of a radiologist for a period of time. But we are working with other local radiology providers and making sure that the care our community needs is being provided. But I think this is an example of how workforce shortages may impact rural communities a little bit more than suburban and urban communities, because it's a model from Radius' perspective that just didn't work for them. but yet so critically important for our community. And really, when you we're about the smallest hospital that has a full-time radiologist on site. Most of the smaller critical access hospitals just rely entirely on or mostly on access through telerad, and then may have a radiologist a couple times a week or a couple times a month. So we were very pleased to develop the relationship with Skagit Radiology, and we'll keep you posted on how that transition occurs. I wanted to speak a little bit to our campus expansion presentations and give you an update on how that project is going. We've had four meetings with the community that I think largely went well. Each time we get a color of questions that allows us to tailor the presentation a little for the next group. I speak in kind of big, broad, simple terms as to the structural challenges to the building, but in broader terms, it's a building that has just met the end of its useful life, and that's understood. And then I speak to our need and interest in expanding existing services that the community seems to need to have grow, and also introduce new services to Jefferson County based on what we think we understand about who's leaving the community for services and what service projections tell us should be occurring here. So lots of good feedback, lots of good comments. I think I have one more of those to give. And then we'll probably do another round in a month or so when we have a different information, which is a good segue to an update on the project. I think next week have our fourth workshop meeting, and the workshop meeting is when all of the information compiled from the previous 3 weeks, based on what we call bounce meetings, which is when the design team meets with end users on sort of better understanding what those needs are. And what we expect in end of June is some sort of very high level concept box placement of square footage, where that could fall on the campus, the services and possibly proximities of those services in some sort of concept design. Far cry from, you know, the pictures that you see gracing the cover of a master site plan, but some sort of crude, hey, this is what this could look like, here's where it could go, here are the, based on square footage, the services, how they could lay out, and it seems to check all of the boxes that that we set out to and that have been validated by community feedback. And when you get to that point, you will also have a range of magnitude cost estimate. Up to this point, there have been far more questions than answers. I think end of June, we'll still be, you know, for 40,000 feet above it now, we'll be down to like 10,000 feet, but a far cry from here's what we want to build, here's what it's going to look like, and here's what it's going to cost. But we should be able to give some sort of rough understanding that I think we can take out for another bounce to the community. Middle to end of July, we'll have to refine that and come back to you with, this is a more refined version. This is what the contractor says that they can build. Here are the services that will go into it and how they will line up. We know enough about finished features and cost of construction to give a cost estimate, and then that information could be taking forward if a ballot measure were to be considered. So a lot of work the next 2 months, going from sort of exploration, understanding needs, to here's what we think we should build and here's what we think it's going to cost. And again, roughly 2 months from now, we'll be at that level, with 1 month from now sort of the first glimpse of, hey, this is what it can look like, here are the services in it, and here's a range of magnitude cost for you. We've talked quite a bit about our operational and cultural improvement work. We engaged the Huron group to help us with that, and we have sort of launched it internally with a mostly organic effort led by, I think we're calling ourselves Team Mojo, but it's a group of folks who are framing the work to our directors and leadership team to help define what this journey is going to look like, but also provide some quick hitting resources and structure to working on engagement. That work has gone great, and it's been helpful and even fun. On June 21st, we're having our first LDI or Leadership Development Institute. So resources from Huron will come in. I think it's out at Port Ludlow. All of the leadership team, all 50 of us or so, will be out there. And there'll be a full day presentation on organizational culture, behavior standards, commitment to this work, and sort of the official launch of this effort. So we are looking forward to that. Great work done by the leadership team of Allison and Brandy and Tina and Jake and Tyler and Tammy Tarsa and Mitzi and Dan and Kelly O'Connell, kind of this group of SLG members and leaders that I think are giving a real good perspective on what this work should look like. And then before I turn it over to Dunya, I just wanted to call out a real fun Hospital Days week. Great fun to see the barbecue back and all sorts of t-shirts and other prize giveaways and Jesse and Brittany and Shannon did an amazing job putting all this together and I think good times were had by all. We sort of learned other things that are best received. You can't go wrong with free coffees, unless you only offer them free espressos from espresso stands. Unless you only offer them in Port Townsend, we learned that lesson. So now we have vendors in South County and Ludlow, so everybody can get a free drink. But it's just a nice way to give out Jefferson Healthcare swag and mostly just give out props to a workforce that really has earned it, deserved it, and hopefully appreciates it. The Roadie Parade was a big success. I've seen lots of really cool pictures, and thank everybody for turning out. And then the Roadie Run on Sunday. We stepped into that probably about 8 years ago as kind of a quiet sponsor, and have maintained that sponsorship mostly because we think it's a great event, and it really does encompass our interest in community wellness. But I'm told that was a great event as well. Different venue. I took it from Fort Worden and took it out to the fairgrounds, but a lot of people participating in the run. So I'm going to ask Dunya to give a little update on advocacy now.
Sounds good. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you for your report. Excellent as usual.
Sure. Thanks.
So some of our state work, our current focus, again, is on upcoming engagements with our legislators around the new building and workforce priorities. And this week, actually, we're actually really stepping into preparing for the legislative session 2023. So get everything on the books for that. Understand what could be coming down the pike and then begin that planning process. Next slide, please. I can't believe I haven't spoken with you since we went on our trip to DC. I think it went really, really well. That's the three of us who were there in person in front of Representative Kilmer's office that we got to meet with. Masks were off only for the picture, so don't worry about that. But we met with Senator Murray's staff, Senator Cantwell's staff, Representative Kilmer, and some of Representative Kilmer's Health LA. So we were quite busy for the couple of days that we had these meetings. And so a lot of work has happened. We also have some follow-up meetings with the additional help staff that are being scheduled and that have already happened. So really working hard on the federal side of things. And we talked about our agenda last month, so I won't repeat it for you. Also, some of our federal advocacy work, again, was around the Jefferson Cancer Treatment Project. Some of that work is moving forward. We spent most of last week making a video. I wanted to say thank you to the people who participated, our patient participants, and then Aaron, Roth, Sally, Mitzi, Donica, Michelle, Corey, Sean, our movie star Jake, Tina, Dr. Murphy for always thinking first about our patients, and then a huge thank you to Commissioner McComas. I really appreciated your participation in that and hearing more about Terry. So it'll be an amazing video that we'll be able to use for all of our advocacy work to talk more about getting a linear accelerator here to provide radiation oncology to our patients. So a lot of fun stuff happening. And I'm going to say that I just got a hint today of some potential good news for some of our federal asks around that, but it is not yet on any websites. And so I'm hesitant to put the cart before the horse or do anything to, you know, shift up the stars. So I will have hopefully good news for you next month about some of that work. Next slide, please. And then also, I'm Googleable. So the Government Accountability Office found our white paper. They were directed by Congress to do an investigation into behavioral health care and critical access hospitals and why CAHS are unable to provide specialized behavioral health care services. So really that moderate to severe mental illness, intensive outpatient treatment, day programs, that kind of thing. So why can't CAHS do that? They were doing some of their background research and they searched in Google and they found our white paper, which feels pretty amazing. I feel relatively famous for that. Mike and I were then invited for a one-hour interview with the GAO. They are a nonpartisan agency that really does a lot of research and makes a lot of recommendations to Congress as they're thinking through legislation. And I think it went really, really well. I sent them 15 documents as a follow-up and have more in the queue to keep sending to them. So they are working hard to understand sort of the kernel of the issue of why we cannot provide those services without receiving a cost report hit for our overhead allocation. And we'll see what comes of it. But that was really, really exciting. We also met with AHA staff to bring them up to date on current CAHMA initiatives and look at it more from a nationwide perspective. I think that we have spoken ad nauseum with the hospitals here in Washington state, but it impacts every single CAH across the country. So that work has been going on as well.
Dunia? Could you please describe CAHMA CAHMA for those who are not used to it?
Absolutely. So CAHMA is the Critical Access Hospital Modernization Act. It was an initiative that we started in 2018, so it's been about 4 years now. And it's really trying to understand why and provide solutions for the fact that critical access hospitals have a limited set of services that they both received cost-based reimbursement for and overhead allocation too. And so whenever we provide services that are outside of that list, our overhead is thinned and is reallocated to those services and we get less overhead for those. So there is a 20-page white paper on our website that dives much more into it, but really, as Mike and I have been talking about for years, the question is, why can't we respond to critical health needs to our community in a way that is financially sustainable? And it's really this interesting designation of what falls in to the Medicare cost report and is an allowable cost report service under that sort of spectrum and why things are not.
Thank you, Dunia.
The precipitating event to all this work was the work that we did, the due diligence work that we performed around purchasing Discovery Behavioral Health, where we expected to take an operating loss based on that service being outside of cost based and knowing that our expenses would raise. But what we didn't expect, and we thought that there would be some relief for, was the cost report, the cost allocation cost report penalty that that purchasing DBH would incur. And just the high level summary of that, $400,000 that we currently are able to allocate onto our cost report of our overhead, just by purchasing DBH, we would no longer be able to do that. So in addition to losing $250,000 in operations, there would be this real cost report, real dollar implication as well. And as you know, as we step into this discussion with the GAO or the AHA, whoever's wanted to talk with us, that just didn't make any damn sense. And so most of you were at the meeting when we said we would look at this, and that was very well received by the community. And most of you were at the meeting when we said this, we can't do this, and that was not received very well by the community. But just like we couldn't understand why a rural health clinic shouldn't be able to provide dental services because an FQHC can, we feel the same way about critical rural services like behavioral health, skilled nursing facilities, home health and hospice. Those are services that critical access hospitals in most of the communities they serve need to provide. And this sort of arbitrary cost report penalty needs to go away. So everybody we've talked to agrees with the premise and our rationale, and agrees philosophically that the world has changed and critical access hospitals need to change with that world. But they also agree with, this isn't a philosophical discussion, it's a political one. and it's going to drive more spending and give a boost to cost-based reimbursement care, which there is a pretty controversial topic to begin with. So we have been sent down 50 different paths and trails. But the reason I share all of that with you is that we're still working at this, and it really was the result of the failure to be able to justify DBH, and our commitment to the community is we'll keep working at trying to figure this out, because my hunch is it's not just going to be behavioral healthcare services that critical access hospitals will be looked to provide, and COMA will help us do that.
This is critically important work, Mike. Do me a thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions?
Thanks,
all right. You said it was on the website. Is that on our website, the full COMA 20-page report?
It is. It's under our advocacy page, under the About Us.
Thank you. Yep.
Dr. Mattern is on the line.
All right.
Are you there, Joe?
I'm back.
Yes. Yay.
Hey, Joe. Hey, Dr. Mattern. Welcome back.
How's it going? Thanks. Yeah, it's good to be back.
There you are.
Yeah. I'm really, this is the week two of me being back. So my head is still getting reoriented to things. So I don't have a ton for you, but I think I could give you at least a little snapshot, particularly on COVID and just, I think, a little bit of what'll be grabbing my attention for the summer. Just with regard to COVID, I think if you're looking around the community right now, it feels like, does everyone have COVID? It feels like someone you know has it or has recently been exposed to it or is it testing for it. And the reason for that is that there's a very high prevalence of infection in the community right now. We had a good meeting on Monday, and Allison, our medical you know, Board of Health director, and she was able to join and give us a kind of some perspective. One of the perspectives is, what's your real rate of infection versus what you're reporting? Because in Jefferson County, she said, I think the numbers today reflect close to almost 1,000 cases per 100,000 per 2 weeks. But she said, probably to be on the safe side, the actual number of infections is probably double that. And so, but she said, hey, don't worry, actually across the state, the numbers that the state reports, probably multiply that by six. And the reason why is, in different communities right now, you have some communities where there's no testing happening and people really aren't that interested in finding out whether they have COVID. And you have other communities that are more engaged and still involved in testing. And I think we have one of those communities, but despite that, between home tests and people having mild symptoms, we're probably underreporting. That's the bad news, that we're that high. And in fact, if we are close to 2,000 cases per 100,000 the last 2 weeks, it would mean that close to one out of 50 Jefferson County residents had COVID in the last 2 weeks, just to give you an idea. That's a pretty large number. But here's the good news. We've talked all along during the pandemic of the fact that we want to decouple infection from disease, and in particular severe disease. And that means hospitalizations, and that means deaths from COVID. And that is, in fact, what we continue to see, not just in our community, but across the country, which is that the rise in hospitalizations, which has risen across the country, has not been at the rate corresponding to the number of infections. So that is a combination of more immunity across the population, a lot of that from vaccination, also exposure to other variants with the virus. The other thing, too, is an increasing access to treatments, particularly on the outpatient side for people who have COVID. And I think one of the reasons why you see low hospitalization rates in our community still, despite higher numbers, is that I think we've done a really good job of increasing access to antiviral therapy. Really, the team over the last couple months, as the availability of medications like Paxlovid have become more available, we've also gotten better at rapidly identifying people who have positive results, either through our testing or through their home testing, and giving them the option for treatment, getting them consultation if they would like, identifying those high-risk members of our community, whether they're vaccinated or not, but individuals who would be more likely to have severe disease, getting them prescriptions for these medications. And it makes a difference. That's supported by the outcomes on the initial studies. And we're seeing that translate into practice. When you see some higher rates of maybe hospitalization and maybe a little rise in the number of deaths, particularly on the East Coast compared to here, it is possible that we benefited from being a little bit behind the curve because we're a little further ahead with our rollout of antiviral therapy. So I wonder if that could possibly represent some of the difference. Having said that, I'm always looking at New York. They're usually 2 to 4 weeks ahead of us. We're seeing possibly their cases begin to trend down, their hospitalizations begin to trend down, which means hopefully we're also kind of hitting that peak. And so even though we're seeing less activity, we're not seeing zero activity, and we're hoping that we'll continue to see deaths from COVID continue to stay flat. Other things that we still don't know about, those outpatient infections that turn into long COVID or other complications from COVID disease, it's too soon to tell, given at this point. We have put things in place, and we've begun to roll out the booster, the expansion of booster vaccines, kind of more of a clear recommendation for a second booster for people 50 and over. And you're also seeing now the booster rollout for 5 to 11. So we're beginning to administer that. So again, we're going to kind of continue to increase the protection, continue our antiviral rollout, which we've also expanded to more primary care providers, and we're starting to see some comfort prescribing in the urgent care setting. So this should be the future, which is that if you're a primary care provider or you work in an urgent care setting or the emergency department, just the way that you should feel comfortable prescribing antivirals for influenza. We should get to the point where you should feel comfortable prescribing antivirals for COVID infection. So I think we're on our way on that journey, which is good because I don't think that COVID will disappear completely, even as rates go down. We don't know kind of what the next few months will look like and sort of what sort of if things will cycle back up into another surge or another variant. We hope not. But so right now, the biggest thing, because I think our systems are working pretty well, the biggest thing that Mike hinted at that we're dealing with is staffing issues. I think we think a lot about sort of being able to kind of fill shifts for the emergency department and the operating room staff and the ACU, but it's very much on the outpatient from the outpatient standpoint as well. So as we've had infections in folks and people have worked extra shifts, even if they're not infected, they're still looking for their summer vacation. So we have pent up time that people need to take off because maybe they're working extra to cover for people who are sick. So we have some staffing deficiencies, coming up in the next month in one of the clinics. We're looking at medical assistant shifts that we have a number of openings and we may have providers who have to share a medical assistant. And so when we are in situations like that, that may change our access. And so this is the reality. So from the patient experience, they're going to continue to, at times here, hey, we don't have as many appointments available, or we're going to have to push that out a little bit further. And it really comes back a lot to staffing. We have been fortunate, coming back and taking a look at the current medical staffing, at least from the physician and advanced practice clinician standpoint, we're in pretty good shape. We have a couple of retirements and resignations for personal reasons. We have a couple of primary care providers for family reasons who need to move out of the area and work out of the area. And we have a Dr. Forbes, I think is retiring this year. We've been able to fill a couple of those roles, but we continue to search for providers. Fingers crossed. I think actually on a clinician stand from a clinician side, we're doing pretty well that way. Filling roles for supporting positions everywhere from the front desk to nursing staff positions to medical assistant positions continues to be a challenge. So and then when you have other complicating factors like needing to switch radiology services and things like that. So we're juggling a lot as an institution. I think it's a real credit to all the folks who are here that when things are kind of flowing as smoothly as they can, despite all these things, it's a real credit to the staff. Certainly a lot of work to try to fill positions and stabilize the situation through the summer. Any questions about COVID before I just kind of make a few comments a little bit about just some other work that I think is going to be coming up? So just last thing I want to talk about, coming back, I came back and needed to stay in town, but Dr. Butterfield and Dr. Harris were able to attend the WISHA, actually it was WISMA, sorry, the Washington State Medical Association conference on provider wellness and burnout, which I was able to attend a couple of years ago. It was quite good. We're going to continue to debrief on what we think that we can do as far as next steps. We've been talking about this for several years now about how do we manage the impact of burnout on healthcare providers. And there's always been a lot of focus. Yeah, I think the kind of initial focus was you got to fix the EMR, you got to fix efficiencies, you got to make it easier. And I think where you see the trend moving towards, that sounds like this conference kind of pinpointed, is that we need to really talk more about reconnecting to the purpose of the work. I think, COVID-19 probably challenged our thinking around burnout and got people thinking about what was most important. So we can't just be thinking about efficiencies. We need to think about, our staff. And I don't this is not just physicians or advanced practice clinicians. This is all the people who work in healthcare. But we really need to address the humanity of our staff, and we need to be reconnecting and talking about you know, the work and how we're connected to our work, but also how we're connected to one another. And I think this, the longer that we continue to have these surges and find it difficult to get together and be in the same room, there is a toll with that because we do see that the inability to kind of regularly connect and, you know, share meals together, get together socially. So it's difficult being healthcare providers because even if you're fully vaccinated and you feel that if you, you know, have a COVID infection, that your overall risk of significant illness is low, it is difficult to leave a already short staff for 7 to 10 days. And so healthcare providers have another layer of caution and something that we have to kind of carry as a burden. And so it's a difficult situation for us to be in right now. But I think that we still need to work towards getting together. And so you may have seen that we are going to move towards trying again to hold our symposium, you know, rescheduled 2 years in a row. But I would hesitate to try and reschedule a third. So I think we're going to really try to make that happen because, again, I think from a medical staff standpoint, we need to revisit ways to reconnect with one another. And so hopefully with lower COVID numbers and better weather, we can find some opportunities also over the summer in some outdoor venues to start to hold events again. So that'll be some of the work that the medical officers will be working on as we move forward. So and just if you get a chance, the part of the reason I wanted to bring this up is that you may have seen in the news this week that the Surgeon General announced and put out a 72-page document calling healthcare provider burnout a national crisis. So it's important for us to take that pretty seriously and continue to renew our efforts. So good to be back. Happy to take any questions.
Questions? Thank you so much, Dr. Matter. Welcome back. We missed you. And we appreciate you.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate you all too.
Okay, then in that case, we will go ahead now to board business. Unless, Mike, do you have anything further on your...
Can I ask a quick question, Jill? Are we doing an executive session?
Yes.
When are we doing
that? Correct, Mike, we are.
Yes. Just at the it's not on the, I'm just going to do it at the end, or it's not on the agenda?
It is on the agenda. Turn your agenda over. The agenda is 2 pages.
Okay. So.
And it was announced.
Yeah, I heard that. What time are we aiming for? Is it just?
Just as soon as we conclude our board business and our evaluation, then we're going to go right into executive session.
Okay. It's 5:45. How long do
you think it's going to take, Mike?
15 to 30 minutes, just real quick.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. So we will now go on to board business. Board of Health, do you have any comments?
Yes, I do. Thank you. First of all, I sent to the commissioners the report that I gave to the Board of Health last week about what's happening with Jefferson Healthcare. And I want to thank Mike again for sending me a few comments to include in that report. The great news is that Dr. Allison Berry, our public health officer, was awarded as the Professional of the Year in Jefferson County by the local Chamber of Commerce last Saturday. Obviously a well-deserved award. At our next June meeting of the Board of Health, 10 entities and or individuals will be invited to participate and to receive the 2022 Public Health Hero Awards that we give every year. And I'll let you know the results of that after the June meeting. In addition, we have new bylaws for the Board of Health. I think you're all aware of the changes that had to be made because of state legislation, and we're currently looking for tribal representation on the Board of Health as required by state law. Public Health received a climate change grant from the state for $11,000. It's mostly for staff training. It's especially looking at issues related to wildfires and excess smoke problems in the county. And that's ongoing this month and next month. In addition, the school-based health centers received a grant for an extra day of counseling at four of the public school health clinics in the county. This is very good news, and it's going to help build capacity, increase the capacity of those clinics to deal with emergency situations that come to them from the youth in this county. We are not alone in having trouble filling vacancies, in a large part because of the local housing crisis. And the Public Health Department also has five positions currently open. So it's not only a problem for Jefferson Healthcare, but also for our public health partner. And finally, the Director of Public Health, Apple Martinez reported on the latest University of Wisconsin Public Health Institute ranking of counties across the country. They do this each year. And we rank among the healthiest of counties in the state. And I suspect that's in part because of the excellent quality care that our residents get here in Jefferson County. At the same time, we also have one of the highest levels of child poverty in the state. Fully 17% of children in this county are in poverty. And in addition to that, 27% of children live in single-parent households. So again, these are children and families that that need all of the help we can find in the community and who benefit from the great care we provide. So that's all I have to report.
Okay, thank you. Lots of good information. I was going to report that Duni did a great job on reporting on the AHA membership meeting, so I won't go into that. And is there anybody else that has anything to report? Okay. Well, then in that case, we can go to our meeting evaluation and then we'll go into executive session. Mari, how was the meeting?
I think it was excellent. Good information. It was also reassuring to get our audit, our annual audit report. And yes, very good information. So much going on. Thank you.
Matt?
Yeah, I agree. Nothing to add.
Bruce?
I agree with what Mari and Matt said. I mean, great reports always, and it was a great audit. And thanks again to Tyler and his group for making that happen.
Mm-hmm. Case?
I'll second that. And when you think of all of the things that this small critical access hospital system does in this county and what we have on our plate, it's really remarkable that we can keep it all together, including dramatic plans for the future, as well as dealing with the crisis of the pandemic, and at the same time, providing quality care by staff that is really dedicated. So, yeah, good reports.
Yep, all of the above, I agree. Thank you. Okay, then we will now go into executive session. Do you want to take a 5 or 10 minute break? And then Glenn, are you good with going for another, say, 25 minutes? All in favor of just going right on? Raise your hand. Okay, let's go ahead and go on then. It is 5:26, and we will return to this platform in, say, 25 minutes?
Yes.
Is that done? Okay. So that'll be, my math is terrible.
Do we have a different link for the executive session?
Yes.
Yeah, 25 minutes. And
we do, Matt.
Okay, thank you.
And that's in our inbox, is that right?
Yes. So everyone, please go out from here now, leave this platform and go on the other platform. And we'll be back here, well, let's call it 5:55.
Turned us on.
Okay, it looks to me like, let me make sure it's 5:54, so we'll wait just another minute because we promised 5:55. There, all right. It is now 5:55. We are back from executive session and no action will be taken. Is there a motion to conclude the meeting?
So move.
Second.
Second.
Is there any discussion?
No.
Everybody in favor of closing the meeting and concluding? Raise your hand.
Aye.
Okay, aye. Great. Aye. See y'all later. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bye.